Hi, and welcome to the How Not to Think podcast. A podcast that gets you thinking in different ways, challenging binary thinking, conventional thinking, and all of that sort of stuff. My name's Dr. Howard Rankin, and I have a special message for you listening in today. You need to listen to this show. You need to listen to it. This will unquestionably, in my mind, change your notion of yourself. What is self? Who you are? You know, the old joke is, if you don't know what introspection is, you need to take a good hard look at yourself. Well, that's actually what we're going to be doing today with my very special guest, and I am totally honored and thrilled to have him with us, Dr. John Leaf. He is an amazing psychiatrist with tremendous clinical and experimental background. And I came across him by reading his recent book, and we'll talk about this throughout, and I'll mention it many times, The Secret Language of Cells. Now, I could go spend a long time talking about Dr. Leaf's accomplishments, but he does have degrees from both Yale and Harvard, so that tells you something about him right there. He's been a very experienced psychiatrist, forming journals, associations, blah, blah, blah. That's enough for me. Dr. John, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for your kind words. Thank you.
Yeah. No, really, this is a mind-blowing book that anyone really, I mean, it's crazy to say this, but everyone should read it, because it will transform your sense of who we are as organisms, as animals, the whole sense of, is there a natural, the question, is there a natural intelligence? How far does this extend in the world? And you have taken research, proven research, and you have put it in a way that is pretty easy. You've taken out all the jargon and you've made it pretty easy for people to understand. And when they read it, they will see some amazing things. And the fundamental part of that is, of course, the communication that goes on amongst these billions of cells we have inside us. So tell us about that amazing communication that happens between so many different types of cells, molecules. It's mind-blowing.
So everyone learned that neurons talk to each other in circuits. They send neurotransmitters and signals. So we all learned that pretty much in high school. And it's well established in the culture, but it's not well known, even among many scientists, that all cells talk to each other in the same way and in many other ways, in very complicated ways. I mean, neurons don't just do neurotransmitters. They send immune signals off the side of their axon. They use electrical fields. They send sacs, little sacs of information to the myelin cell making cells and other cells like astrocytes. But so we know about neurons, but we never knew that capillary cells, which are very intelligent, skin cells, gut cells, immune cells are all talking constantly to each other, and microbes are included in that conversation. We learned 30 years ago that microbes send signals to each other. It was called quorum sensing. In other words, the group make a decision together. They say, we're all here with a signal. And they say, should we attack? Shouldn't we attack? And they do a lot of other signals and they communicate. They send resistance genes. They send all kinds of information back and forth to their comrades. And they help other communities, and they don't. But we never realized until recently how influential these signals from microbes are. And now every day you learn about some new way that a gut microbe is influencing obesity or influencing the brain, influencing diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. But the reason why microbes can be so influential was not totally clear or obvious, but it's very simple. It means they speak the same language as our cells, which is a language. We're just learning about this. The science is getting so good that you can see molecules. So most of what we've learned are secreted molecules, but cells actually love to communicate in a variety of ways. They make little nanotubes between each other. Cancers love nanotubes. They take a bunch of very significant molecules like DNA or RNAs or proteins, even a mitochondria that they've altered, and they put it in a sac and they send that off. And cells love to do that. They also communicate through electricity, through gradients, telling where to stop when making a limb through an electrical or chemical gradient. We're just learning about the electrical and the photon communication that's going on. Also, light, you know, changes, hits a molecule, changes one particular bond, which alters the shape of a molecule, and everything happens through the chemistry of shapes, and the shape then bangs into another, influences another one, and then a cascade starts that's then amplified. And that's how one photon in the middle of the night in the darkness, we can distinguish, human beings can distinguish six photons in the dark. And that's because the six photons hit six rods, and then it's amplified thousands of times through these cascades of molecules, of signaling molecules. So one of the biggest things we've learned is the neuroimmune communication. And these are circuits that include many cells, not just T cells and neurons, but astrocytes, microglia, even skin cells, microbes, all kinds of cells form circuits that communicate about immunity. So I don't know how far I should go or where I should go with this, but that's sort of,
That's great. And what underpins that is the sort of my incredulity at the different types and the sophistication of the communication that goes on. I mean, people think, well, you just signaled I'm here, that's it. But no, they're signaling to others, you know, like T cells, you got to come right now because we got a problem, and send some more, and go over there and go this way because that route's blocked. I mean, it's mind-boggling, isn't it? I mean, that I'm right about that from your book, right? I mean, right. These cells communicate how to come, you know, watch out for this. It's mind-blowing.
One of the smartest cells in the body is the capillary cell. That's the lining cell of the smallest vessels where the oxygen takes place, the transfer of O2 and CO2. These tiny little capillary cells actually sit in the organ and tell the organ when to make more cells, what kind of cells to make. They tell the stem cells. Their stem cells are sitting right next to them, and they communicate, no, you need more of these, you need more of these. And it's funny, Aristotle had said everything's directed by the blood vessels, and everyone thought he was crazy until a couple of years ago when we realized he was right. I don't know how he knew that, but it didn't make any sense. But that capillary cell notices there's an infection in the tissue and starts signaling to whoever will listen at first. And usually the first responder are platelets. And platelets we think are a plug, but they're not. They're an intelligent cell with all kinds of messenger RNA. They make all kinds of proteins, say receptors and signals. They then, the capillary says, no, we need neutrophils. We need this particular immune cell. They signal all the way to the bone marrow. And these cells start marching along even against the flow of the blood by grabbing onto the edge and moving along. And all this happens in the cell by a scaffold that it's like an amoeba, you know, they bulge forward and they pull it back. And all this is being orchestrated like the way an axon is built in the neuron, but it's happening almost instantaneously. They're building these large scaffolds to move the nucleus forward, to move the front forward, to bring up the rear. And all of this is going on because that capillary cell is signaling, then it says, come this way. And then they arrive and they say, I'm here. So the capillary says, okay, you sure? They signal back, yes, you're the one. And they open a pathway between the cells so the leukocyte can squeeze through. I have a great picture of that in my book, mm-hmm. of a leukocyte squeezing through. And then once they're in the tissue, the leukocyte kind of takes over from the capillary cell to direct the action, and they make a circle around it, and the ones closer signal back. But they're all waiting for the T cell, the master cell. So the T cell eventually arrives, and the T cell takes over the direction and eventually figures out exactly what receptor it needs for this virus or this bacteria, and then helps the B cell make antibodies and helps direct the action. And then they have to stop and tamp it down, or they damage the tissue. So then another kind of T cell starts saying, no, no, enough, okay, enough. And that's why they're not as good with cancer, because cancers are multiple different parts of different characteristics. And it's like a community of different subcultures in the cancer, and the T cell gets used to fighting one of them and then is used to tamping it down. But this fight with the cancer is going to go on for weeks and months. And therefore, a new T cell has to learn about the other subsets. And so T cells aren't as good with cancer, although they can be. And we've sort of learned to help them by learning the communication. We then can make treatments. That's how treatments are made, by understanding. So it's actually much more complicated. In other words, it used to be you study the kidney and you'd study a kidney cell. You know, that's what you thought. But now, no, you have to study the neuron, the capillary, the microbe, all these things all over the body are talking. The fibroblasts are talking about that kidney cell. But at least we know where to look now. And when we look, we can find signaling communication systems that we can intercept and interact with. And that's what, of course, microbes do. They learn the specific communication that's going on, and they manipulate it. And that's what cancers do. Cancers manipulate their local communication. Anyway.
And that's fine. No, that's great. I mean, so many great things. When I was reading about T cells and reading about what you've just said, I have a son who's in the army, and it reminded me so much of really the same sort of dynamics of a military operation. The identification of a threat, call up the appropriate, you know, what seems like the appropriate forces. They come in, tell them which is the best way to go and how to get there, right? Then they assess the situation, and then they would call up more specific resources to deal with this, and on it goes. And that is what is happening at a cellular level. Am I right?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to paint a picture to show clearly how elaborate, complex, back and forth, 100 times back and forth, communication is going on at the cellular level. That it's not just there are cells, it's that these cells are talking to each other and appear to be intelligent. I'm loath to say that. I'll get attacked by someone because we don't even know what intelligence is. We have no idea what intelligence is. But from ordinary thinking about it, it sure looks like they're intelligent.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think, yeah. And I think it does define some of that. And just another thing there that just kind of blew my mind with a sort of army or military analogy was the fact that potential T cells are called to the thymus, right, where they go through training, sort of like Ranger school, right, and make sure that they are appropriate enough for the front line and don't end up, you know, killing the wrong cells, right? And what did you, I think the statistic was like 98% of them drop out and
they're removed.
They have
to pass tests.
Right.
And there are a variety of ways this occurs. One of them is called a nurse cell. It's a huge cell that takes the T cell into the middle of it and then sends all their proteins. Cells never make all the proteins. That's how they determine the difference between a muscle cell and a neuron, is that the DNA is only using, the odd number of genes or the even number of genes, but here this cell just bombards the T cell with all kinds of molecules and sees if it can handle anything. And because it's going to meet anything, because the viruses are going to come and they are mutating constantly and they're bringing all kinds of molecules. We create synthetic molecules that we eat that nature has never seen before. The T cell has to deal with that. So the T cell can deal with any molecule, but it's even more subtle than that. Because yes, we can deal with it, but how strong are you? Are you too strong? Are you too weak? It's a very subtle determination that we don't understand yet. But so what I explain in the book is that the T cell has to be able to talk to other cells. Like the T cell tells the neuron when we're sick to create the sick feeling. So we lie down and take care of ourselves. When it's the infection's over, the T cell signals neuron no. So the T cell has to be able to talk and have enough of a relationship with this cell to talk to it, but not kill it, because the T cell is incredibly powerful and it can instantly morph into a killer. And that's a whole process that has some checks and balances, but it can go awry, as we see in multiple sclerosis and other autoimmune diseases, the T cell's capacity to kill cells. But so it has to be able to communicate, but not too strongly. So the judgment that those thymus cells in the thymus college or university are determining this incredibly subtle thing that we don't even understand, that it can deal with anything that happens, and it will deal with it so that it can make a big attack against an army of viruses that are here, but it won't be so big that it can't be stopped as soon as the infection's over and tamped down, and it won't run around killing our cells. So it's amazing how smart these T cells are.
Incredibly smart. And that raises that whole question of the sort of natural intelligence. It raises a question also about how much of this activity really drives our behavior, our, you know, any aspect of this. Yours was the second great book I've read. Yours was better than this one, but this was pretty cool. A book from the 1990s by a Danish guy called Tor Nordtrander, called The User Illusion, which looked at some of these similar things. For example, it was about consciousness, really. And one of the things was that in various studies, the movement, the neurological beginnings of a movement actually occurred a half a second before somebody was aware they'd made a decision to move. So the biological, neurological activity actually predated the consciousness of making a decision, which then raises the question, how often does that happen? Does this massive amount of communication going on inside us present us with messages, ideas, emotions, and what have you, that subsequently we become conscious of and sometimes think, oh, we've created it? But that might be an illusion.
Well, these early studies that you're describing were used, I think, incorrectly to say there's no free will in nature. And then later, Ledoux did some stuff of the same kind, found 500 milliseconds. Very recently, that has been refuted by other studies that show a much smaller lag. And so, but the bottom line is so much is unconscious. So much of what we do, we're not sitting here directing our heart, our lungs, we're not directing our breathing, but we can direct our breathing if we want to. We're not directing our muscles, and we're driving cars on automatic pilot. And most of us succumb to, and particularly today with the phones, we're susceptible to the influence of, it used to be gossip, now it's just media. And we're susceptible to this all day long. And so the question is, what is conscious? What is conscious behavior? Mm-hmm. Well, to me, there clearly is some conscious behavior. For example, meditation is a conscious act of affecting things. So you can often use that as a measure. What's interesting to me in this new science of of cellular communication, particularly is the neuroimmune circuits. So the neuroimmune circuits have recently given, which I've described in the book, a new understanding of how meditation can affect immunity. It was not clear how that could happen. I mean, everyone knew that, and how acupuncture works, which I can mention, but the way meditation works on the heart and the breathing and the gut calming things, it's been clear the parasympathetic, the vagus nerve is very involved in that, but no one realized until recently that the nerves can alter immunity and send cytokine signals all through the in the various immune, in the lymph nodes, the spleen, in various places. And so the nerves are determining the levels of inflammation and triggering vast numbers. 200 genes of immunity are triggered through meditation. The other thing I should mention is of all the external signals that we're getting, by far the most significant is perception. So our mental perception of what's happening has the greatest influence on our immune cells. And the fact that, like, if we're lonely, that will affect like hundreds of cells, different kinds of cells, and affect hundreds of different genes. Perception, of course, is a very complicated subject that we don't understand, and it's based upon expectation more than bottom-up sensory. It's more the bottom-down modulating. So we don't understand really how exactly that works, but it clearly is a driver of the environment's effect on our immune cells, and the conscious activity, like meditation, would alter the immune cell as well. I may have gone afield of your question,
That's good. No, that's great. And of course, there are levels of consciousness. And with Grant Renier bringing out a book called Intuitive Rationality, which is in the cognitive neuroscience behavior economics field. And of course, you know, Kahneman talks about system one thinking, which is, you know, not very thoughtful. It's almost like rubber stamping something you already know or want to know. And then there's critical thinking, which is serious, conscious endeavor. And I like to quote George Bernard Shaw, one of my favorites, who said, "I've made a very good living for myself thinking twice a week." And if he meant critical thinking, he's probably right, because so much of the time, I think we're on autopilot, as you say, especially today when there are so many distractions, so many things to look at, the attention economy, that, you know, we're not really thinking. It's automatic. And I suspect that in those cases, that's when all of the stuff that's going on is presenting us with things, and either we ignore them or we just accept them or we don't. And that becomes fascinating. And although I agree about Nortrand, some of that may be out of date, one of the questions he has about consciousness is perhaps consciousness's best attribute is the ability to what he calls veto it. So something comes on you have a thought in your head, you don't automatically accept it. You have the ability to say, no, I'm not going to do that, or I'm going to do something else. But so much of the time we're on autopilot, and what you're describing, I am sure, influences what goes on in your head and how you respond to it.
Well, a lot of it's on the cellular level. Neurons, astrocytes, microglia. The truth is, I've studied neuroscience in great depth, and I've lectured on it for many years. And I used to treat very complicated neuropsychiatric patients. I ran many, many hospital units for 45 years with these types of patients. We don't have any idea what consciousness is. We don't know what thinking is. When I first started my blog, I was paying attention, writing a lot about neuroplasticity. And I even won, the website won an award among the top online universities competing with Oxford and MIT and Stanford. But because I was producing a lot about neuroplasticity at the basic level, but it became apparent to me that we don't know, have any idea what subjective experience is, and there's no part of the brain that is subjective experience. I mean, it just isn't there. And there's no modules. They used to think there were modules, but it's not. Each cell is connected with many other kinds of cells, sensory, motor, various. It's not like we used to have these compartments that were very right. narrow in the brain. They're, most areas are association areas, what used to be called association areas. So it became apparent to me that we haven't a clue of what consciousness is or what thinking is. So I started studying other, you know, animals. And I wrote a lot of articles about animals and then insects. And that actually led me eventually to cells. And all this is on my website, by the way. I have many articles about how smart ants, individual ants. Now, everyone talks about the hive, and the hive is interesting, like the internet is interesting, as like a super organism of human consciousness, and how the microbes have seemed to have a super consciousness in the world. They're sort of directing the atmosphere, and but the individual ant is extremely intelligent, not the as well as the hive, but the individual ant can take 50 different kinds of information to determine where it's traveling and how to get back. And not only that, but you can teach it a new one. They taught it how to do magnetic fields and to use that, and it learned. Now, bees are unbelievable. They have symbolic language. They have abstract concepts. They have a kaleidoscopic memory of miles of flowers, and then they solve the very advanced mathematical problem of called the traveler's problem, traveling salesman's problem, where you have to determine where to give more energy among a wide variety of places and trying to figure out to maximize, you know, business would use this, you know, to maximize your effect. They figure it out with flowers, like where to maximize their effect over a long period. And they self-medicate. They know when the fungus is there. They know what kind of fungus. They know when to treat, when not to treat. Ants, too, know how to treat illnesses. Termites are unbelievable. I have an article about termites. Termites build a structure that is far beyond anything human engineers could even conceive of. It's like a skyscraper, like the World Tower. It's that big compared to them. It's in the middle of the desert, and yet it becomes like a refrigerator, a cooling device. They develop a mechanism to cool the air, and then it becomes an oasis for all the animals. So these huge 6 foot high things are the center of the life of the animals, and it totally changes the ecology. And they know how to build this. And not only that, but so you come up with a knife and you cut it. Suddenly, an army ant surrounded, very vicious, with big jaws, special ant, special termites. And then the other termites come and rebuild it exactly the way it should be. How do they know this? I mean, how can a termite know how to build something vastly more sophisticated than anything humans can do? But that's only the beginning, because the molecules in the mitochondrion are so far advanced from anything human beings could ever build. It's unbelievable. This is a thousands of amino acid structures where electrons flow through a channel that has little rooms based out of iron and sulfur and then copper and then iron. And then there's a protein one. And each one is slightly lower energy, just slightly, so that the electron gives up energy here, here, here. It's going all the way down. And then way at the bottom, the oxygen molecule that we breathe in eats the last bit of electrons, and that's the lowest level of electrons. And while this electron flow is going on, there's also a water channel, and there's a proton channel where protons are pumped through this process up above the membrane. And then as they flow back in way over here, they come into this unbelievable complicated molecule that is a piston, where as the proton comes back through, it turns. And as it turns, it moves molecules and makes ATP, which all of life depends upon the energy of ATP. Now, this molecule existed 3 billion years ago in microbes. We know that. So this incredibly sophisticated molecule that we couldn't possibly build today, human engineers could not build it. We don't even understand it. And a lot of it has to do with quantum characteristics of the electron and the resonance going through the microbes building. So that's why I was so astounded by cells. I mean, to me, while the termite and the ant and the bee are extremely amazing, and humans are amazing, and that we have culture and science and everything going, and the internet going, the cell, the microbes are more advanced. They're more sophisticated engineers than we are. And they rule the earth. You know, everyone says humans are going to kill themselves off, and they might, but the microbes, they'll be happy. They'll just move on.
Absolutely.
Move on. Yeah, you know, absolutely. We had an oil spill in the Gulf, and everyone says, oh, disaster. The microbe says, no big deal. We'll eat it. They ate it up. Now they're eating the plastic. I mean, you know.
It's mind-blowing, because it makes you wonder who built the Sphinx. Perhaps it was, you know.
Well, they
perhaps it was termites. You know, who know? But I mean, this stuff is simply mind-blowing. It's at a level that is way beyond certainly where most people are thinking about this stuff. I mean, the natural intelligence, I mean, you're talking about animals there. And I, you know, I'm a big fan of Franz de Waal, and I'm sure you may be familiar with him. I just love his work, and, you know, his book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? You know, this is going on all the time, and that behavior is unbelievable. And
I had the honor of writing an article with Mark Bekoff, one of the great animal people. He's written a lot of stuff about dogs and other things and cats. And so what we did is we compared, he wanted me to help him compare the brain of a bird, a small brain. So we know big dolphins, whales are very intelligent. Elephants are remarkably intelligent. Dogs, we know, are very intelligent. Horses, pigs, very intelligent, but birds are the most intelligent with this tiny brain. How does that happen? And then you have the bee and you have the lizard. Lizards are supposed to be stupid and reptilian, but they aren't. They're very fast. The anole is like lightning fast in cognition and solving problems. And they also have mammalian characteristics, like taking care of the young, some of them. Swim with them back from an island and watch out for them. But we compared the brains of these three small brains that have capacities way beyond humans in some ways. I mean, we have more thinking ability. So we think, we don't know what. We at least can do science and quantum mechanics and things like that. But, and culture, you know, we have that. But animals have some culture also. Mm-hmm. But birds, crows, are extremely intelligent with a small brain. And it seemed to be that they have advanced neurons like us in a totally different structure. The structure is different, but some of the neurons are just as advanced. And octopus, they separated 500 million years ago in the Cambrian explosion. They separated from us, and yet they developed very extreme intelligence. All of that family, the squid and cuttlefish, they're extremely intelligent. Anyway, but it all pales when you get down to the cells, and then you see these structures that the mitochondria is building and the photosynthesis is building. I mean, they're vast quantum mechanical machines that we can't even understand, let alone build. So yes, it was remarkable to me the more I studied cells, and that's why I felt I had to write the book.
Well, I'm so glad you did. Now, talking about cells, and not cell phones, but Wi-Fi exists, right? There's Wi-Fi communication between these cells too, right? Don't know whether they have 5G yet, but it's pretty good, right?
Microbes are very small. So compared to us, they're much smaller than we are to Mount Everest, for example, just as a point of reference.
Right.
Very, very tiny. Mm-hmm. Our cells, a couple of thousand times bigger, it's still very, very tiny. I blocked your question. What was your comment, your last one?
It was about Wi-Fi.
Oh, Wi-Fi. Okay, so what they do is they build these nanotubes that are small little protein that transmit electricity, electrons, and they'll be down deep in the soil eating off of a metal, because they can use iron just like we use oxygen for electrons. Respiration is basically eating electrons, and we eat oxygen electrons, and they eat. But we use iron in that channel in the mitochondria, where iron's part of the process. But a microbe can simply attach to the metal and eat off that, which is why some people think the thermal vents in the deep sea with the heat and the membranes is the beginning of life. It's not proven, but there's some of the elements are there. And then what that microbe does is it shares the electrons along a tube that goes 6 inches. Now, an inch to a microbe is like walking along the wall of China or walking to California, in terms of size. So they share these electrons to their brethren, and even other colonies join in on eating the food that they're sending. So I call that the microbe internet. that are connected. And then, of course, in the forest, all the trees are connected through a network of fungal wires where they transmit information, they transmit food, they transmit warnings. So the plants have their own internet, and plants would never have come from the sea onto land without the fungus network. I know it's plants and the fungus network are completely intertwined. There's no real separation. Neither would exist without the other. So,
yeah. And then when we talk about, when I was reading about cancer and cancer cells, it's sort of a bit like using the Wi-Fi for fake news and spreading misinformation, because actually that's what they do, is they interrupt the normal information to do all sorts of things that prevents them from being attacked, hooks up with other people, other cells, using resources. I mean, it's mind-boggling. Yeah.
If we consider the T cells smart and the skin cells smart and the gut, and I describe the many, many, many things they each do, the cancer cell is like a supercell. It excels in, so the cancer eventually affects the pathways that deal with self-repair and with stopping dividing because things aren't right. There are certain checkpoints, and the cancer cell damages those pathways and becomes a cell that can multiply forever and live forever and change its own metabolism. Like a T cell can suddenly switch from one cell to like 1,000 fighting big strong cells using energy very rapidly. They have the ability to manipulate their metabolism. They alter their mitochondria for these altered mitochondria, and then they create nanotubes. They love nanotubes. There's two kinds. There's a short, thick kind and a very good, long one, a little smaller. They can send these altered mitochondria to each other to strengthen their comrades, and they'll send resistance genes in packets. They like to send things in these packets of exosomes. So they'll send some DNA like that you need to fight this medication that we're being given. like microbes, they're in a community. They're a community of cells. And then they start, what you're saying, is manipulating the local fibroblasts, the structural cells, to build a structure. They interfere with the communication of the blood cells and create their own blood cells that don't allow that process we talked about earlier, where the immune cell will come through. It blocks the immune cell from coming through. Immune cells are altered where they become part of the structure. And it's not like they just multiply. They build an organ. They build a city. They even have the ability, which is amazing. You know, when in the fetus, there are a lot of kinds of cells, but there's two kinds that are basic. One is the epithelial cells, which sit in place and form a structure, and the mesenchymal cells that move, are mobile, and form the connective tissue in between. And then later, everything reverts to a more static situation later. Cancer cells have the ability to both become the mesenchymal cell or give that ability to the fibroblast, so that they'll have one leader mesenchymal cell who moves, and attached to it will be 10 follower epithelial cells, and that will be a great group to go form a metastasis somewhere else. And then they send a sac filled with all the signals you need for that particular tissue. So some cancers understand the local dialect of the bone or the brain or the breast more than they would the liver or the kidney. So they form their metastasis there. And they do that by sending these sacs filled with a lot of genetic information. And they could sit there for a long time. They could just hibernate there and then start up later. And you only need one stem cell, just one stem cell to start the whole thing rolling again. Yeah. So they're extremely, and when viruses attack, they send the resistance genes, they fight against them amongst themselves, just the way a bacteria would. You know, they're smarter than bacteria. I mean, they're 1,000 times bigger than bacteria and have way more complexity. So they can do everything microbes do. Plus, they understand building a structure in a human way. So they are amazing cells. I have a chapter on all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's really good. Well, good would be a severe understatement. You know, I'm thinking that if you made an animated movie about all the stuff, it would make, you know, Superman look stupid and pathetic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd wouldn't be wonderful. It? Yeah, I mean, wherewithal to do that, but
But if, I mean, seriously, even if you can just imagine it, it just makes the superheroes look pitiful. You know, yeah. It really does. And you know, we're just touching the surface here. Their ability to communicate isn't just like nearby. They can communicate right across to different parts of your body that are relatively miles away. Right.
Yeah, how do they understand that? You know, how does a capillary cell know that the bone marrow is down here and know where things are? And, you know, it's remarkable.
Yeah, it's really, 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 it's just mind-blowing. It really is incredible. And I think it is important for people as much as possible. Everyone's not, you know, very few people are doctors and, you know, biochemists, but you've done a great job in trying to explain this to people in a way you at least begin to get some idea of the amazing complexity, the apparent intelligence. I mean, I don't know what else you use when these things are so coordinated, where the messaging is so coordinated, and you know, when the cancer cell is so deliberate, it seems to be in trying to, you know, get rid of the defenses and, you know, mess up the T cells and the immune cells. I mean, it just gives you a different perspective, I think, on life. I really do that.
And there's a big movement to describe the way cells self-edit their DNA. Like they can actually alter DNA using jumping genes, using cut and paste, using, 50% of the DNA are jumping genes, which are basically viruses, virus-like strands of DNA that have an encyclopedia of different abilities, and they can take one of them and move it here and move it there. And it's not yet proven how deliberate that is. Like, we can't say it's deliberate, but it certainly appears to be somewhat deliberate. But, you know, I stay with proven things in my book, and that's
yes,
not
you do. Proven, so. No, no, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate
so
much.
Oh, I should mention, so when I used to work in the hospitals, you know, everyone asked, do you speak foreign languages? And I would say, yes, I do. I speak molecular biology and molecular genetics and microbiology, and as well as neuroscience. Those are the languages. Because when you read these papers, it's a gobbledygook hodgepodge of letters and words that make no sense to anyone. It's a completely foreign language, and each field has a different area. Now, I spent the time to study these different fields that would impact upon my my website and my book, but most experts don't. Most experts know their limited area, and it involves the name of a gene, maybe five different names of a gene, because it was invented and they called it asparagus and then they called it something else. And I mean, the names make no sense. They're just scientists inventing stuff because they feel funny that day. And or it's the letters of some lengthy chemical. So there's the names of the chemicals, the genes, the receptors, the signals, the pathways, the enzymes, the transcription factors. And it's complete. No. So what I did for my website is I would take a major review article in a field and basically translate it into English. I viewed myself as a translator. So I would then write a post, and I wrote over 200 of them that are just basically translations. They still had some jargon, but much less. You know, it was basically in English. But when I wrote the book, I decided that I wanted it to be a book that anyone could understand, that a ninth grader could understand. So I eliminated all jargon except, you know, like the word white blood cell or platelet, you know, certain things you can't eliminate if you're doing a chapter on platelets. But basically, and I know, and as I was writing it, people would say, oh, well, put in jargon to explain it. I'd say no, and I struggled to just explain it in English. So that's why. And yet it covers real
stuff. And you did a fantastic job, and that's why your book is so good. I mean, the same material presented in science language, I wouldn't have got past the first page. I just would not. I would have been overwhelmed with, I don't know what all these things are. And you did a phenomenal job in saying, I'm understanding this. I'm getting a picture of this. This is fine. I don't need to know that. It's phenomenal in what you've done there, and it's so important. Otherwise, all the stuff they say seems so sort of esoteric, and people aren't going to read it. They're not going to relate to it. But people need to read your book. They need to understand what's in it, what you have translated, you know, because that is so critical to understanding. It potentially changes your view of yourself and of the world, I think. And again, that would not happen if you hadn't taken the time to say no jargon, really, because there is no jargon in it. I mean, yes, you name the cell and that cell and all of that, and that's fine. And honestly, that you don't need to know that. You know, as you're reading, you can say, okay, that's what these things do. And that's what those things do. And, you know, what they're called doesn't matter. You've got an image of them. That's really very, very significant.
Instead of calling it an epithelial or endothelial cell, I call it a skin cell.
That's right.
And I call it a lining cell, a blood vessel lining cell. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of a macrophage, I say a cell that eats things.
Right.
So, I wanted it for the younger generation, really, because the older generation are stuck in their, you know, when scientific revolutions occur, people think, oh, the new idea is great. The older professors dig in and never change their mind and want to keep their grants and their professorships exactly the way they are and keep their students. So they never change. It's only the young people that take on the new ideas, and then they gradually become the thought leaders. So it's really for that, it's for my children's generation. Really.
That's good. Not old people like me. Okay. Well, no, I agree. But that does
you're
happen.
One of the few older codgers like me. I don't know how old you are, but who are willing to look at new ideas. There's a small club of scientists where things are changing, where the old random, everything has to be random in order for it to be scientific, which is just ridiculous. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. When it can't possibly, you can't build an ATP enzyme randomly. I mean, it can't be done. You can't do what DNA does randomly. So anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there's all of this basically intra-organism communication going on. Now, what about evidence for, and I think I might know the answer to this, but what about evidence for intra-organism? I mean, cellular communication between two individual organisms.
Right. Well, we're just, as you know, we're just learning. So most of what we know are molecules. So clearly everyone can understand that a bacteria talks to another bacteria, which are two organisms. A fungus talks to a plant. The bacteria talks to a plant. In fact, they make deals. The plant need nitrogen. They cannot survive without nitrogen, and they don't have good ways to fix it from the atmosphere. So they make a deal in this route. They send out a signal, and then a bacteria applies, says, oh, I'm a friend. I can help you. And it back and forth maybe 100 times till they find this is for real. It's not a pathogen. It's not going to hurt us. And so they say, okay, you're going to come in and make oxygen for us. So they make a road out of calcium. I call it the yellow brick road. It's a calcium oscillation, which is like a highway into the plant. And there they say, okay, here's where you are. And then the plant builds a factory around them, and they multiply and they fix oxygen, give it to the plants. And then in return, they get all kinds of sugar and all kinds of goodies. So it's a deal. So that's a clear back and forth. But in one sense, everything is cell to cell. But, you know, so when we touch something, our touch cell versus another person's touch cell, when we send a pheromone, a smell, it's from a cell and it's picked up by the receptor of a cell. So in one sense, and even light, you know, certain animals have figured out how to change their molecular characteristics so they bounce off certain light and appear a certain color, like the way octopus can and cuttlefish can change and make this all transparent. This is all through understanding light bouncing off the back and forth between cells. So there are a wide variety. Clearly, it goes on. We just are learning about it, about how, you know, it's hard enough to figure out a cell to cell in a place where you contain, let alone in the forest or outside.
I was thinking, you know, specifically mirror neurons in terms of replicating what you see, practicing it sort of subconsciously, and stuff like that. I wonder how much of that is just like you described, or is it more sophisticated than that? That there's somehow some cellular connection going on there beyond what's obvious and conscious to us.
We don't really know how neurons work. I mean, it used to be sort of the first view of neuroplasticity, which of course is the capacity to change the brain to learn new things or to solidify learning, was that you amplified the structure of a glutamate cell, and that was considered neuroplasticity. But as you see in my website, there are at least 30 elaborately different ways that neuroplasticity occurs, and it occurs brain-wide. It doesn't occur in one circuit. We used to think, oh, this little part is happening. But in actual fact, almost anything we do mentally involves most of the brain. Right. And in microseconds, such that we can't even measure it. In other words, the kinds of studies we're doing are seconds and slow. Most of the activity is in microseconds, and the same neuron is part of one circuit, one microsecond, and another circuit, another microsecond, and it involves 30 different kinds of neuroplasticity strengthening particular circuits all around the brain, and some of that happens through epigenetics, some of that happens through we don't know. I mean, we're just beginning to learn about that. But clearly, to me, brain-wide neuroplasticity is what we're after in learning. Can I talk about that for a minute?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so I'll just give an example. Is a high jumper is about to high jump and visualizes the high jump, goes through the process, and therefore the high jump is 30% better. But if during that visualization, the high jumper goes like this with their hands, it's 45% better. And that's because they've enlarged the circuit of learning to include the muscles. So they have the muscles and the visualization and the thoughts. All these different parts of the brain are solidifying a behavior in memory, some form of action memory. And so that's why certain things are more significant to us than others. Like, for example, music. Mm-hmm. Playing music uniquely involves most of the brain. It involves moving in rhythm, and rhythm is a unique capacity in the brain. It involves the meaning of the song. It involves being somewhere with friends. It involves the name of the band, the history of the band. It involves, mm-hmm. it could involve a spiritual meaning like a church service, mm-hmm. A gospel service. It involves movement and the group and all. So it involves and cognition and the knowledge of how to play the instrument and the knowledge of the voices. So it involves a huge amount of the brain, which is why music training is one of the best ways to create just a smarter person. Mm-hmm. They get more capacity. But my understanding is that meaningfulness is what matters. In other words, meaningfulness means attention, emotion, details, mm-hmm. Striving. So it could be gardening. It could be anything yep. that involves meaning, involves these large circuits, which then creates the strongest neuroplasticity and impression on the brain. And of course, we've learned now, everyone used to think it was static, which is why the prejudice grew about old people that they're stupider. I mean, it used to be you think they're wiser. Now everyone thinks they're becoming demented. Which is not true. Dementias are disease entities that are not. But if a elderly person uses their brain in meaningful activities, they build new circuits all over the brain, from the frontal lobes, from the right and left, all kinds of communication circuits occur, so that the capacity of the elder brain is far better than the younger brain if they use it, except for one thing, which confuses people, is word finding. So word mm-hmm. finding does seem to get less. Oh, what is that word? So they think it's stupid.
Right.
But actually the pattern recognition is better. So I have an article on my website about mm-hmm. how elderly brains are better than young brains. Mm-hmm. Some people will enjoy when they feel their brain is running down.
Yeah, when they can't remember why they went into the pantry, right? No, absolutely. No, I agree with completely. And what you have just said, is one of my, hobby horses or something that I get on the box with, which is about training and education. We still look at education as about learning facts, okay? Verbal memory, remember this fact and repeat it. That is not intelligence. That is not education. Okay, there is a huge difference between experiencing something and knowing a fact. And clearly, experiencing something in a meaningful way just is completely different, because probably it involves the entire brain or a whole lot more of it than just perhaps the memory of, you know, this is when this battle occurred, you know, and it just is not integrated. We know that. It's so clear. It's just not integrated. It's just not put into schools or education. It should be the fundamental, the point of education.
Right. And the infant, it turns out, has a lot more capacities than we ever thought. It seems to have a myelinated area for language before they're born, which is crazy. How does that happen? And then the babies, the very young babies, like the scientific method. They like to explore, try this, try that, and they learn best. And then after a while, they stop doing that when they're acculturated
in the way
that we're teaching them. So the babies are extremely good at learning and figuring things out in a way that how we deal with it will determine whether they're doing that.
Yeah, no question about that. And I really do think that, you know, you understand why from sort of the brain energy point of view, but binary thinking is so common, and young children don't have binary thinking. You know, if you say to a three-year-old, you can have the ice cream or the cookie, they'll say, why can't I have both? Which is a perfectly good question. And it doesn't mean they're greedy. It means they don't understand binary thinking. They're still creative. They're still open, you know. But, you know, down the road, they get acculturated, and it's either this or that, which is so limiting, so aggravating. And, you know, don't get me started on that. But you know, that's, you know, that in a way is what you were talking about science before. Very binary. Oh, this part of the brain is for this, and this part of the brain's for that. No, wrong. Why can't they both interact in so many different ways? And yet that binary thinking is the thing that just perpetuates and is responsible, I think, for a lot of the problems that we have, because people will see it as either one or the other, and it isn't, right?
Yeah. No, we don't understand the brain, that's for sure.
Yeah,
you understand a little. I mean, to me, neuroscience is very exciting, but to say that an fMRI shows you a particular mental state is really not proven. I have some articles I wrote about that. And neuroscience studies. There was a very interesting study that where. Neuroscience studies usually involve an N of 30, 50, 100. Mm-hmm. So they did an N of 2,000 and found it was completely different than completely different. And then they did like one task or maybe two or three tasks. And then they did a study of 500 tasks and it was completely different. Mm-hmm. So we're not studying the possibilities and we're then extrapolating from that. So neuroscience is a much more primitive field than the hype we have right now, although the imaging is very exciting. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I love electron micrographs of cells.
Oh, yeah. My favorite MRI study was where they showed that dead salmon could identify people through their MRI. This is actually a study published. I don't think they set the machine right, but I agree. I think it sounds too good to be true, a lot of it, right? And when you're talking about the complexity of the things that you're talking about, it can't be that simple, folks. Just can't be that simple.
The brain is so vastly complicated. I mean, if cells are vastly complicated, the brain is even more, because each neuron is a cell. I mean, just my chapter on dendrites, I think, and on axons in the fourth section. Fourth section of my book, it's divided. I had to divide it up because divided into the body cells and the brain, even though I don't think there's any difference, just to talk about it. So the skin, the the gut, the cancer, but then the brain cells, each of the brain cells, then the microbe world. But then the fourth section are compartments, organelles. And two of the compartments I talk about are transport of material along the axon is one, and then how do dendrites make the decision from the inputs, the thousands of inputs. And it turns out it's mind-bogglingly complicated how they do it. I mean, we don't understand. It can involve geometry, it can involve timing, it can involve multiple things or not, or linear or not linear, or digital versus analog. So that chapter shows the vast complexity of brain, I think.
And you have to question whether we as human beings have the capacity to really fully understand all of this. I mean, that's an open question, but it's a legitimate one.
Right. I don't know. Well, we do know that we cannot, like the electron micrographs are great and the x-rays are great of cells and molecules, but we do know that once you get to the size below electrons and quarks, that the only way we understand anything is through light, is through bouncing a version of electromagnetic energy off of something. And then at some point, it stops. We've reached the limit. And below there, we're not going to be able to observe. And yet, if you take the quantum mechanics, which is a fairly accurate theory, although it's not perfect, there's another 30 orders of magnitude below the quark, down to the down to the Planck size, mm-hmm. the smallest conceivable size. And in that 30 orders of magnitude, when you consider orders of magnitude, 26 orders of magnitude takes us to the entire universe, and 26 down takes us to a quark. It's just a cauldron of energy. And to me, that's where, if I was going to speculate, that's where the string theorists are, but that's where consciousness would be to me. That's where whatever the molecules of consciousness are, so that the molecule is smart, but the cell is smarter, but the human has more capacity to think. To me, it's physics. They're aspects of nature. I mean, it's just consciousness to me is a continuum of something that's like matter and energy. Yep. They call it information, but we don't know what information is. We don't know what information is. Information is computers and digital and mathematics, clearly, but it's also DNA code, and it's also the resonance of the electron. And we have no idea how to define. Some physicists, very smart physicists, think there's matter, energy, and information, the three of them. But that's not proven. I mean, that's we just don't know.
You know, and that's, you know, the height of wisdom is to recognize what you don't know. So that's good. A couple other things, and then I'll let you go work on your next book, because we could go forever. One thing that I know you talk about, I think you talked about on a previous show with Andrea Sumdi, which was about sort of miracle cures, that whether some of these things are going on, you know, beyond what human beings think of or are conscious of, and you can suddenly find somebody miraculously recover from something. I actually wrote a book with somebody who had an experience like that. It was very interesting. She actually in 2009 had the SARS virus and was in very poor shape, needed heart transplant. She was in a coma. When she came out of the coma, 2 weeks later, she had some recollection of sort of dreams or whatever in her. And when she looked at and talked with her family who had been by her bedside the whole time, it seemed like that her dreams were related to things that were going on. So that when her heart was being, you know, she's being cardioverted, she had this dream, quotation mark, of driving down a highway looking for electricity, for example, and stuff like this. And she had a religious spiritual experience in this where at one point she thought she was dead. And then Satan-like figure came and said, follow me. And she almost did and didn't. And then an angelic figure came to her and said, look, your heart will be healed and you will see through different eyes. And when she woke up 2 weeks later, she did see through different eyes because she'd had a stroke that had affected her vision. And when the doctor came and said, come on, we need to see, you know, how bad your heart is. He came back and said, I don't believe it. You have a heart of a 20-year-old. This is a heart that we would transplant. Can't explain it. Cannot explain it. Spoken to the doctor. I can't explain it. So clearly something happened in her to heal her. Now, what the relationship between her memories, a conscious experience, and is going on there is just clearly speculation, right? You know, was she somehow healed through her cells and somehow this manifested in this sort of story that she created? Who knows? Did she have the story and it changed herself? Who knows? I just wondered what your thoughts on something like that are.
Well, I have a couple of areas of thought about it. First of all, I should mention for 40 plus years, I ran hospital units for neurodamaged people. And some of them, I was able to have brain injury programs where I could observe patients for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I ran more than 10 large brain injury programs that had up to 100 patients, as well as the hospital unit. So I was able to observe a wide variety of brain states and situations of this kind. And I have seen personally some remarkable things. A patient who, well, it's a long story, I won't go into it, but basically was found on the streets of New York and was like a wild animal, couldn't communicate with her, and she was completely out of it. And she was sent to my facility. And over a 10-year period, we gradually learned that her vision was a very particular skewed way. And we gradually learned to communicate with her. It's like a Helen Keller kind of story. Mm. And then eventually, she, with the human contact, she started getting better and better. And eventually, the drunk man on the streets of New York who had found her and brought her to the emergency room spent the next years trying to find out what happened to her. He eventually found out that she was brought to our facility in Boston from New York. And he came, and we had to treat his alcoholism because he was still drunk. We said, you can't come in here if you're drinking. And through the motivation of that, eventually they eventually got married.
Oh, my gosh.
But anyway, and she sent me a letter 3 years later. You know, it's only because you believe in this that it would happen. So, I mean, I have a lot of stories I could tell. But on my website, I do have some articles. I mean, the bottom line is we don't know the answer to your question, obviously, but I did write four posts called Extraordinary Experiences. And again, everything I write is based upon just data and facts. Mm-hmm. But I wrote one about savants. These are people, and you can, again, just Google John Leaf, MD. You have to spell my name right, though, unfortunately, and it's terrible. Most people don't. But maybe at the end, we can tell them how to spell my name. But John Leaf, MD, Extraordinary Experiences. And there's one about savants, one about religious experiences, mm-hmm. out-of-body experiences. I mean, out-of-body experiences are actually quite normal because it was proven in California you could wear video.
3D, yeah.
An audio video mask and virtual reality. Mm-hmm. You can stimulate out-of-body experiences that way, but in anyone, and you get it when you're in a satellite, and you get it in whiteout conditions, you get it a lot of different things when you're weightless. Anyway, the one about savants is interesting because many of these savants, some of the savants were normal people who then got brain injury and then develop this unbelievable capacity. These are fantastic capacities. They can see a scene once, just a moment, and then draw it in great detail, like incredible detail. They can hear this without any artistic training. They can hear a piece of classical music and sit down at the piano and play the piece of music without any training. Mm-hmm. They can do math things like what was, you know, in 1796, March 3rd, was it a Tuesday or Wednesday? They can figure that out. Rain Man is an example. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they can do pi, you know, to 30. And a lot of these are from being bonked on the head. And it's almost like we're inhibiting our extraordinary experiences, and then we release them in some way. That may be what psychedelics do. Religious, you know, you do religious practices and you release these experiences that we have access to, but we don't know how to get to them. So I've written 4 articles about that. Again, I don't have any magic understanding of it, but I've seen, you know, things happen in the hospitals that are unexplainable, you know, remissions, they call it,
yeah, you know, right.
That don't make any sense, you know, cancer everywhere and then suddenly it's gone.
Absolutely.
That happens. And I've seen that, but the studies do not lead anywhere yet. One study of all the miracle cures of remissions of cancers, some people did what I would call a healthy holistic diet. Some people drank beer. I mean, some people, there's no rhyme or reason to what caused the remission, but I can think of it as a neuroimmune response from the cells. I mean, clearly it makes sense to me from the vantage point of my book. It makes sense.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then lastly, and then we'll get to where people can reach you and the spelling of your name, so they get the right person. In terms of what we can actually do to benefit us in terms of lifestyle behaviors, clearly there is some big connection, poorly understood at this point, but some of it is, in terms of the sorts of things you mentioned, meditation previously, sorts of behaviors that we know probably are actually helpful in preserving our health and integrity.
Right, and brain health. So cells need to work and do their metabolism, and they need certain energy, they need certain foods. So clearly, not eating chemicals, not eating strange processed things that the cells don't know what to do with is advantageous to keep the cells healthy, because if we eat chemicals that they have no experience with, it just accumulates as garbage and debris. So the kind of foods we eat matter. And of course, it's a common thing, you know, vegetables and fruits and berries are better than pills because we don't know what's in them. It's not the flavonoid, it's 1,000 things. It's one, that's
right,
one.
Right.
1,000 chemicals in a blueberry. We know the blueberry, if there's anything miraculous, it's a blueberry for health. But then of course, grains. And then the other thing is the kinds of food we eat attract the microbes. That's clear from the book. So if you eat a lot of vegetable stuff, you get one kind of microbes. If you eat red meat, you get a different kind. And the red meat microbes like to eat carnitine from the red meat. And then they create a chemical called TMA, which then goes to the liver, becomes TMAO, and that creates atherosclerosis. So this mechanism is not the red meat causing heart disease, but the microbe that likes that meat is causing the heart disease. That's one thing. Now, sleep is becoming obvious that it's more and more important for several reasons. One of them is that it reconsolidates memory. It allows the brain, what the brain does is it loosens the energy on all the synapses. It cuts it in half. And if you look at energy, the body, the brain is 3 pounds. It's a small percentage, tiny percentage of the energy. It uses 20% of the energy. If you cut that, and most of it is the synapses, if you cut that down to a quarter, you're saving a lot of energy, which is one reason why sleep is so restful. But it also, the neurons shrink. And then there's a flow of fluid through the neurons. It cleans away the debris, which are often these misfolded proteins that cause neurodegenerative disease. So there's a cleaning process. There's multiple cleaning processes, the choroid cells, all kinds of cells. But one of the major ones is this thing that, and we've just learned it goes to a lymphatic vessel, which we never knew about. But and so the reconsolidation of memory, the cleaning of the brain with sleep, it's very, very important. So that's very important. Exercise is like a magic bullet for neuroplasticity. However, there's a window of neuroplasticity after the exercise, which you can use for good or for bad. Like if you take a rat and a mouse and you exercise the mouse and you get that window and you give them cocaine, they become addicted much faster. They learn the addiction. Mm-hmm. So you can learn bad things just as fast, faster, or good things after the exercise. So it matters how we use the brain. And then, of course, we come to that very significant thing we already talked about is meaningful activity. Using the brain builds these circuits. There's one particular thing I want to mention. So we used to think there were no new neurons after the fetus, but we now know there's about 1,000 every day, half of them in the memory centers, and that new memories associate with the new cells. And eventually, if they take, they form circuits and they gradually grow stronger and the old memories kind of fade, but are still there, but they fade. So we can then use this for traumatic experiences. So we have a traumatic memory and every time we re-remember it, we're actually taking a new cell and making a new memory. And what we can do is consciously associate this new remembrance with some loving things that have happened, something positive, to just counteract the negativity and gradually chip away at the strength of that memory through using the reconsolidation process and the new re-remembering process. And then the other thing is, we don't understand why, but there's something unique about nature. Just walking in nature, brainwave, you're in a meditation. In other words, the brain goes into meditation just walking in the woods. And if you give a little plant to someone in a hospital, they get better. If you can see a tree down the road in your apartment, it's better. So whatever we can do to get into nature is also a very beneficial thing for these brain cells. And again, I don't have any idea why, but we are completely interdependent with plants. We breathe out CO2, they breathe out oxygen. We're like complementary beings on the planet. And so that may have something to do with it. I don't know. We don't know why, but it's true that it's very significant to these cells. So those are the things I would emphasize.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what's interesting in the talking about trauma, I think I had mentioned to you elsewhere that, my marquee client was a woman who had severe dissociative disorder, what used to be called multiple personality disorder. And one of the reasons these alter ego, and I really think of that as not sort of divided personality, but fragmented, that there are associations with traumas and memories that just get fragmented and separated from the rest of certainly consciousness and maybe other things. Because one of the interesting things about that was in these several alter egos, they had some very specific physical characteristics, like one always had a migraine. And what's interesting about that is if those traumatic memories are so severe that they are separated off and you never want to think about them, that's not good because they don't get recycled, they don't get rememorized, they don't get reprocessed, and they stay there. And I've had some trauma experts on my show before, and I agree with them when they say you have to, however you do it, go through this and reprocess those memories. You can't lock them away because they're still probably going to be influencing you. You have to reprocess them one way or another. And what you said really is just going to reinforce that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have a lot of experience with multiple personality. I have had a lot of experience with trauma, and but particularly brain injury trauma. I mean, they're fairly, the kinds of patients I deal with are very, very ill. I don't deal mm-hmm. with outpatients. I've always run hospitals and residential brain injury programs. Mm-hmm. So I deal with the severe end of things where people aren't functioning. So that's been my experience, a neuropsych medical neuropsych complication is what I end up dealing with.
Well, this has been awesome. We could obviously go on indefinitely, but let's get to where people can reach you. First of all, John spells his name J-O-N, and his last name is L-I-E-F-F, L-I-E-F-F. So tell us where we can reach you.
You know, it's funny. No one in my life ever spelled John, J-O-N, until Jon Stewart of The Daily Show. And then suddenly it became a legitimate name after that. So J-O-N, you already spelled it. L-I-E-F-F was an invented name, you know, generations ago. So it's not like other names. And so it would be John Leaf, MD is my website, or Searching for the Mind. And my Twitter, I'm on Facebook at Searching for the Mind, and Twitter at John Leaf, MD. Twitter's more active, where it's a constant back and forth. I put out articles every day, both new scientific articles and some of my articles. So that's an active way. But my website, I can be communicated with. People can use it for email, and I'll respond. And of course, the book is on the website, but we don't sell it. It's sold through all the, you know, Amazon and everywhere else. So it's the secret language of cells. You've already said that. So,
no, the secret language of cells. Amazing, amazing book. You all need to go get it, and I mean that quite seriously. Yeah, John, it's been awesome having you. First of all, connecting with you, but also having you on the show. We'll continue to promote this. And thank you again so much for your time, your expertise, and what you have done to help us understand ourselves and nature a whole lot better.
It's been a great pleasure.